Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, C.A. One of the glories of democracy is the balance it seeks between the contemplative and active qualities of governance. The arena of public debate is, therefore, enriched by the contribution of those rare individuals who, in themselves, blend the world of ideas and the world of affairs, and leave their mark in both letters and the law. In 20th century American politics, the best example of the intellectual in public life is, unquestionably, Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan of New York. My guest is Godfrey Hodgson, who's currently writing a biography of Senator Moynihan. Godfrey, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you.
It's a delight to see you as an old friend. See you back at Dialogue, Godfrey. This biography you're writing, of course, is a work in progress, as is the senator's own life. But I think we might helpfully find some themes from it to talk about. What intrigues me most of all, fundamentally, is the very basic question of why a biographer chooses his subject. What made you want to write this book about this man?
Well, the obvious reason is that he's a man I know and have admired for a very long time. I think there's another reason, which I explained to him when I was talking to him about on what basis we could work together, which is that I've been very interested in the dialogue, so to speak, between liberals and conservatives in American politics. And he strikes me as a man whose career sort of brings these two strands together. He is not a conservative, but he has understood and articulated many of the things that made people become conservatives. In particular, I think, an indignation about the way the country was being insulted, put down, and unjustly accused. And I think he articulated that more clearly than most people. At the same time, he has remained a Democrat and essentially a classic mainstream liberal Democrat because of his belief that government and only government can perform certain tasks to protect people, particularly the poor and particularly poor children, from the dangers and injustices of life. So that he's understood the conservative emotion, but he's also stayed faithful to the liberal aspiration.
I think that's a particularly perceptive view of the man, Godfrey, and a wonderful reason for writing the book. And I'm moved to ask you this because, as we both know, he's been charged with being veering, that is, from left to right, going from conservative to liberal and back again. But are you arguing that's not quite the right thing, that he's really constant to a set of principles which he enacts in public life?
I think very few politicians can be said to have remained rigidly faithful to fixed principles, and maybe they shouldn't. The great John Maynard Keynes said, that accused him of changing his mind, and he said, "When circumstances change, I change my opinion. What do you do?" But what I think is true is that I originally focused very tightly on a particular episode in Senator Moynihan's life, which was he was involved in writing the speech which President Johnson gave at Howard University on June the 4th, 1965, which was really the high point of the liberal project. It was the point when the federal government, through the mouth of the president in a formal occasion, said that it was going to commit itself to achieve equality for African Americans, and that was going to be done by acts of legislation, if necessary, of a compensatory kind. Now, that was really the high point of the liberal ambition. And within a very few months of that, Senator Moynihan had become part of the editorial board of a journal, The Public Interest, which was vociferously questioning whether the government can really achieve good things of that kind in social life. Now, I was very fascinated by that. And I've, in interviews as well as in my reading, I've really tried to probe that. His view is that he hasn't changed, others have changed. I think he has changed and then changed back again. And the metaphor I used is that political life is not like a locomotive rolling along tracks. It's more like a sailboat trying to get where it wants to in the face of moving winds, tides, weather, and that a successful, skillful politician catches any breath of wind, even if it's not going exactly the way he wants to go, if it's going to move him in the direction.
A willingness to re-examine his premises.
That's right. But I think he was also, frankly, emotionally involved. He was upset by radicalism. He was upset by the reception of what is called the Moynihan Report, but was interestingly really called The Negro Family, A Case for National Action. And the reception of that in some quarters, particularly New York Christian liberal quarters, was very negative and very hostile. He was virtually accused of racism. In fact, he was actually accused of racism.
That's a very good point to make. It's probably both worthwhile to point out this also came about at a very contentious point in American public life.
Absolutely.
In the mid-60s.
And the gap between when it was written and when it became picked up by the press, by newspapers, Newsweek, for example, covered the period of the Watts riot. And suddenly, the question of black unhappiness, black rage in inner city northern ghettos had suddenly become a deeply concerning and frightening and front burner political issue. Previously, I mean, at the time when this report was written, there was a more optimistic feeling. There was the feeling that the civil rights movement had been a success, that the African-American community was being absorbed into the mainstream of American life, that the legal inequalities were being removed, and that then everybody would live happily ever afterwards. Right. And the Moynihan Report, so-called, appeared and was interpreted by the media as being the government's secret explanation of what was going
on.
And it wasn't meant to be that, and it wasn't that. And it is absurd to see it as an attack on the African-American family. On the contrary, it stressed explicitly that the problems were problems essentially of unemployment and poverty. What it did do is to relate the incidence of unemployment and poverty in African-American families to the history of slavery and segregation and inequality.
Right.
In other words, it was said almost exactly the opposite of what he was said to have been saying.
That's exactly right. Now, let's probe that for a moment, because that's a terrific insight into how this man applies his intellectual curiosity to his eventual political opinions. On ethnicity, Godfrey, isn't it the case that he, as a scholar, he began with intellectual curiosity about his own ancestry, as, say, the Irish-American community, expanded that into an inquiry into ethnicity in America, and then took it a step further into the effect of ethnicity internationally, which led to his very prescient views about the breakup of the Soviet Union?
I think that is right. I think one can be more specific. He wrote two very perceptive essays about the one is called When the Irish Ran New York, and two very perceptive essays about Irish politics, in which he makes one point which I think is very interesting, which is that it's part of American legend that Irish politicians were rip-roaring, hard-drinking, wild men. In fact, he makes the point that the classic Tammany bosses of the 19th century were men who went to Mass every Sunday, who were strong family men, and who didn't drink. One reason they didn't drink is a lot of them were saloon keepers who, when they were quite happy to have their customers drink too much, but they weren't going to make that mistake. And he was always curious about and interested in the sort of Irish American tradition. You know, his dog was called Mr. Dooley, after the late 19th century humorist Finlay P. Dunne's classic sort of Irish commentator, and Yes, he identifies with that kind of Irish experience. He was then much influenced by Nathan Glaser, who's now a professor at Harvard, has been for many years a professor at Harvard. And Glaser had been commissioned by a foundation in New York to write a book about the five main groups in New York, which were the Irish, the Jews, the Italians, the African-Americans, and the Puerto Ricans at that time. Basically, I think what happened was that Glaser lined up Moynihan to write the Irish chapter. He was going to write the chapter about the Jews himself, and he couldn't find anybody to write the other three. So he ended up writing most of the book, and Moynihan, I think, topped and tailed it. And it was a very, it's actually been quite a durable book. It still sells quite well. Mm-hmm. So that gave him a kind of a non-anecdotal, more analytic idea of ethnicity. And then he made this, he had lived in London as a young man for quite a long time, 3 years. He was ostensibly a student at the London School of Economics. I don't think that was the main thing in his life. He used the experience to travel and to meet many, many different kinds of people. And he did travel in Germany, in Ireland, in France, and in Yugoslavia. Then in 65, just at the time of this very important crisis in his life, he went back to Yugoslavia to a United Nations conference as an official U.S. delegate. Right. And he came again up against these issues, and in particular up against the way in which the Soviet Union was trying to exploit ethnicity. And the United States, he felt, was not fighting back, was not stating its own beliefs and ideals as clearly as it should have done. And that came back again in his life when, after he'd been in India as ambassador, he went to be President Ford's ambassador to the United Nations. And that coincided with an attempt by many third world countries, but manipulated by the Soviet Union, to say that Zionism was a form of racism.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that outraged Moynihan, and that again brought the issue of ethnicity back in as a theme.
And he took a very courageous stand, did he not, at the UN in opposition to that?
Absolutely. That particular... And he laid about him in a way that upset all kinds of people, including his boss, Dr. Henry Kissinger. Right. And that led to all kinds of sort of dramas and upsets. But, I mean, it is worth making the point that that was a consistent theme. That was not opportunistic, because he'd always been involved in that issue.
I'm very interested, Godfrey, in something else that I know that is going to be an extraordinarily important part of the book you're writing, and that's the man's origins and how he sort of came to be. And I want to turn to that in just a moment. But first, let me take a moment from our conversation to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Godfrey Hodgson, director of the Reuter Foundation program at Green College, Oxford University. Now then, Godfrey, going back to the very beginnings, we speak of a man who, I think in the American imagination, has a kind of patrician aura. I mean, he's certainly a member of an elite group, the United States Senate. He has extraordinary intellectual distinction, but his origins were quite humble. And I'm wondering, would you characterize him as, in many ways, a self-made man?
Well, he is a self-made man. I suppose most Americans are self-made men, in the sense that it's not very easy in American society to get to the sort of eminence that he's achieved simply by birth or privilege. On the other hand, his origins are a little different from a mythology. The myth is that he grew up in Hell's Kitchen, the classic slum on the west side of Midtown Manhattan. In fact, he never slept a night in Hell's Kitchen until he was an officer in the U.S. Navy and had at least one degree and was on his way to graduate school. So part of that myth has been, I think he's sort of in a way allowed people to simplify. His story is actually that of a very classic mid-American family, which was living in Indiana. His family were on one side, his grandfather was the chief executive of a small utility company. On the other side, there were lawyers and middle-class people. His mother was precipitated into genuinely hard times during the Depression by the disappearance of his father. So in a way, the background is that which very, I think, very common in the Depression, of a middle-class family which hit the rocks, rather than some people who'd started in very difficult circumstances.
When does he see himself as an intellectual? When does he, is he aware that that is where his contribution is going to lie?
I think in London.
In London.
And interestingly, both he and his wife have told me that the London experience was very crucial in various ways. Not because, interestingly, not because he sought out or spent a huge amount of time with intellectuals in London. His closest relationship actually was with a family of working-class Irish people who were involved with the Labour Party and with politics, and who he felt very close to. And they were very intellectually curious, and they talked a lot about ideas and politics and so on. I think that stimulated him to think that he, too, could have and would have a political career. But he also said to me something very important, I think. He said his life, like the life of anybody who'd had difficult times in early life, had been largely a matter of chance encounters and random walks. I think it's two wonderful phrases.
It is a wonderful phrase.
And he was on his way back to New York from London on the boat, or from Italy on the boat, and a man kind of wandered in, started talking to him, who happened to know some of the people involved in a political campaign in New York, and said, well, if you haven't got any better to do, why don't you get involved? And so he ended up, as he put it to me, carrying the bag of one of the most important people in the world, who was Averell Harriman, who had been very prominent in the Cold War, and in fact in World War II, and had a fairly successful run for president, didn't make it, and was at that point setting out to become governor of New York. So Senator Moynihan's career began as an associate, or rather junior associate, of the Harriman administration in New York, and it was from there that he made it, not without considerable efforts and some disappointments, to again a comparatively junior job in the Labour Department, where he had a very good relationship with Secretary Arthur Goldberg, later Supreme Court Justice and UN ambassador also, who was, if anything, I suppose, Moynihan's sponsor or patron in Washington. And then Moynihan became very much involved in the so-called Great Society, the Johnson administration's programs, and that's really where he first made his mark.
Speak to us about another part of his success, and that's the way, if I can phrase it this way, he may have evolved in his thinking as an academic, an intellectual, and a social scientist over the years. And what I mean by that is this, Godfrey. Looking back over this amazing 40-year and more public career, he strikes me as having been very much a kind of traditional liberal social scientist in the 60s. And I'm wondering, as you have charted his life, did that stance as a social scientist evolve in terms of circumstances and conditions that he encountered later in his life? Has he changed his view of what the social science relationship with American politics should be?
I think he has. I think he started out not so much with a conscious doctrine, but just with a set of assumptions which were widespread in Kennedy and Johnson, Washington, and in the great universities at the time, which were that it was the function of social science to promote policies, and that the function of the politicians was to apply, if you like, political support, money, trained personnel, and then out of this machine there would come desirable outcomes. And in the end, Moynihan and others in the group of friends who collaborated particularly on the journal The Public Interest, and particularly one friend of his, James Q. Wilson, became extremely skeptical of that set of ideas. And they began to see the job of social science not as being to propose policies, but to critique policies and to really measure how well those policies were doing. Mm-hmm. And I think that he has been enormously influenced by that idea. It's, if you like, it's a kind of a minimalist or a self-disciplined, self-restrained approach to the application of social science.
As opposed to a maximalist approach of several decades ago.
Yeah, but that's right. But also as opposed to outright opposition. It's not he's saying that these people are all witch doctors and they don't know what they're talking about. He's saying we can find evidence, and the evidence tells us certain things. It doesn't tell us certain other things that people want us to believe, but it tells us these things. And on that basis, if the numbers are right and they say what they seem to say, then that can be a guide for policy, but particularly in the context of telling us what we should not be doing rather than telling us rather than designing programs for us. I think that's the thrust of his thinking. I think there's something very important too, which is that he reacted angrily to what he saw as the excesses and the follies of a certain kind of liberalism. And he joined with people who shared his feelings about that and who wanted to attack that classic liberalism. But then he became elected to represent, 18 or 19 million people who were going through a pretty bad time. New York was going bankrupt. New York State was losing jobs, head offices, population even. So what do? Do you denounce the federal government? Do you say there's no hope comes from the federal government, as some southern or western politicians might have done? Not at all. He said, let's see if we can get the federal government to do as much as possible for us. And I think that one of the things that separated him from some of his earlier associates was that as a matter of practical politics, if you were the senator from New York State, it would have been worse than folly. It would have been betrayal of your voters to have gone around denying the ability of the government to do things for people.
Finally, this question, Godfrey Hodgson, as the man who is the biographer of Senator Moynihan, I'm wondering if, first of all, you would be comfortable with this characterization of him as that I'm about to make as a visionary, as almost a prophet, if you will, in American political life. And if that is correct to any degree, it would seem to me it's correct because his has been a monumental career. And I'm wondering how you think it might be itself best memorialized and remembered as he moves now from public life to private life.
I have used the word prophet about him, and I explained that what I meant was not a prophet in the way in which we use that in everyday life. The person who says, oh, it's going to rain on Thursday. It's not just the idea of foreseeing the future. It's the original force of the word prophet. It's a Greek word, and it means one who speaks forth. And I think although the word prophet comes from the Greek, it's also a Hebrew idea that the great Hebrew prophet spoke forth, saying what they believed to be true, speaking as they say, speaking the truth to power. And I think that he has been a prophet in that sense. He has enunciated great ideas, mainly great political ideas, but also political ideas in their full moral and ethical dimension. And I'm thinking there, for example, of what many people found to be his exaggerated rage at the proposals made for removing welfare from small children. I think he reacted in a moral dimension to that. He said angrily that it was a matter of children on grates. And he has always had that sense of the moral significance of political decisions, that these are not trivial matters. They're matters that should engage our feelings and our beliefs. And one of the interesting things is many people have seen his interest in architecture as a sort of a hobby, One of the things we haven't touched on is that his contribution to the avenue on which we sit, which is Pennsylvania Avenue, it's been called the nation's main street. He had the good sense as a junior official to say that this was President Kennedy's idea, or sometimes that it was Secretary Goldberg's idea, but it was his idea that this should be a great boulevard, a great symbolic street linking the White House, executive branch, and Capitol Hill, the Congress, but also that it should be a pleasant place to live and to walk and have a meal. And in fact, he does live there, not at all accidentally. He's chosen to live there. And from the balcony of his apartment, you can see the Capitol in one direction and the White House in the other. Actually, the Treasury building is kind of in the way, but symbolically, it's all there. Now, he's interested in architecture. He likes architecture. He's always been interested in architecture. But this is not just a hobby. This is, he put it very well in a paper he wrote as a very young and unimportant official in Washington, saying that the federal architecture should reflect, I'm not sure the whole string of nouns there, but basically he said it should reflect the dignity, stability, and strength of the government of the United States. Now, that puts him already in a different camp from your classic conservative who says, you know, government's on the backs of the people. We must get government off the backs of the people. Government is bureaucracy. It's wasting people. He doesn't believe that. He believes that government is not always right. It can be trying to do things it shouldn't be trying to do. It can be excessive. It can be wasteful. It can be stupid. But it's fundamentally a moral force which can and should be improving and freeing the life of the people. And I think that's very much the central truth that he, in a prophet-like way, has borne witness to.
Godfrey, that's an eloquent and I dare say very important answer and insight into this man. And I'm sure, like so many other listening, I, with great anticipation, await the book that you are writing about him. Thank you so much for being with us on Dialogue today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest was Godfrey Hodgson, who is writing a biography of Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed. Our technical director is John Tyler. And production assistant is Daniel Setlow. Recording engineer is Kirsten LaCour DeBelco. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Smithsonian Productions. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.